This is Phil Farrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today, May the 5th. It is episode 110. And it was a little sad this week, but we'll get to that in a minute. In the recap for the week, everything is puttering along well. The beautiful granddaughter just grows more beautiful. She's getting to the stage where she's almost ready to walk. And we just have lovely times together. So that's very, very good. I have a little quick follow-up on the whole sugar thing that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. I just finished reading an article on the effect of sugar on elite athletes. These are people who train like 2 hours at a time, day after day after day after day. Okay, it turns out in that case that certain sugary drinks can be helpful for them to replenish their, I forgot what it was called. Their glucose, but it's glycogen, I think is what it's called. Their glycogen levels in their liver. It is beneficial, and they replenish that much faster. I just drove by a guy whose shorts were about ready to fall off. And the crutch was like at his knees, and I was thinking, how do they walk in those? But anyways, okay, back. So... if you're somebody who goes out and runs marathons or trains like crazy and all that kind of stuff, apparently there is some benefit to ingesting a lot of fructose right after that because it does help your liver recover faster. However, they said that benefit really does not hold for normal people. Even those who exercise moderately, half an hour a day, 7 days a week, and it certainly does not hold for those who are sedentary. So that was kind of interesting. Anyways, so yes, I was a little sad this week. I was a little sad. And as the week went on, actually as the weekend went on, I just got sadder. On Saturday, I had some work to do that I just didn't really need to focus that hard on. So I had rented a movie and I was just using it as background noise. And I had ended up renting a documentary called Taxi to the Dark Side. And as I'm watching this movie, I'm just shaking my head. And the more I watch it, the sadder I get. Because it's all very predictable and, you know, just made me sad for America. What the movie documentary was about, in general, was what the United States government had euphemistically dubbed enhanced interrogation techniques. It was about the decision of those in power in government to allow greater latitude in the interrogation of prisoners, to allow sensory deprivation, to allow sleep deprivation, to allow shackling and binding in stress positions, to allow waterboarding. And some of these things of themselves could be considered torture, but certainly, on the whole, when performed on an individual, there's not really any question that it's torture. Certainly members of the Bush administration had gone out of their way to come up with legal briefs and proofs to say, no, no, it's not torture. But the documentary really was built around the story of a man named Dilawar, I think is the way you say his name. He was Afghani, lived up in some little village. His family and his kin were farmers, But Dilawar was always interested in machines and those types of things, and so there was an opportunity for him to be a taxi driver. So his family had said, yes, you go drive taxis, we'll take care of the farm. He had apparently saved and saved and was able to get a new taxi, which is a tremendous achievement. Very excited about this. Shortly afterwards, he drives the taxi over to a neighboring town to try to pick up some fares. Picks up three guys. And in the process of bringing them back, is stopped by an Afghani patrol, who then search his trunk and claim that they have found an electronic stabilizer in his trunk, the kind that is used in missiles, for missile attacks. And the Afghani patrol says, well, there's been missile attacks against this nearby military installation, so obviously you're part of this. And so they haul him and the three guys off to the Americans, who promptly arrest him and the three guys, and throw them in a prisoner in Bagram. As a side note, the people who were at Bagram, running Bagram, and a lot of the interrogators and the prison guards get transferred out of Bagram at one point, and they get transferred to Abu Ghraib, which that prison may sound familiar to you. Well, apparently this Afghani taxi driver is scared out of his mind. And he's always hollering and he's crying for help, for someone to come and help him. And, you know, he's shackled up at night with his arms over his head. And eventually, because they're trying to get him to be quiet, and they're trying to convince him to talk, and they're trying him this, that, the other, and even one of the interrogators, one of the military police interrogators, says on the documentary, after he talked to this guy for the second time, he knew, this guy, he doesn't know anything. There comes a point where the guards get frustrated over the fact that he won't be quiet. And the guards have been told, well, if you hit somebody in the thigh, you know, there's a pressure point there, and that'll make them compliant real fast. And so he's hollering, they're pounding him in the thighs. He keeps hollering, they keep pounding him. And they basically turn his thigh muscles into mush, and then clots form, and he dies. And according to the documentary, this is not like an isolated incident. Even the U.S. military medical examiner who looked at him knew what had happened, and on the death certificate checked the box beside homicide, not natural causes. This guy was literally murdered inside this prison. And as the stories began to come out about Abu Ghraib and all those places, you know, this documentary was done all this, and the documentary shooters, the filmmakers, interviewed the guards who were on the front line of this whole thing. And it turns out that these guys basically were just military police. They were never trained in interrogation techniques. They were given very loose guidelines as to what they could and could not do. One of them said, we ask our superiors over and over. We need guidelines. How are we supposed to do this? We need to know where the boundaries are. And the superiors just kept saying, oh, yeah, well, that's coming. It's coming, but we don't have it yet. But we just need information. Get information from these people. And at the same time all of this is going on, the 20th terrorist of the 9/11 is discovered that he's over in Guantanamo. And so the Bush administration is signing off on the fact that they can use some enhanced interrogation techniques on him. And the word of these enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, floats down through the military to the people at Abu Ghraib and Bagram and those kind of things. And so they say, well, it must be okay for us. So they all start using them. At one point in the film, they talk about the fact that the military has a tendency to attract people of a certain mindset. And the reason that you have a very strict, enforceable military code of conduct is because you don't want that all that energy getting out of control. And what you had in these prisons is you had superiors basically cutting guys loose to do, well, men and women loose, to do whatever, and the justification was, well, we got to get this information. It's really interesting because a couple of the prisoners made statements that I thought, yeah, and as soon as you do that, here it comes. Made statements like, well, people were being told to rough up Iraqis that wouldn't cooperate. This was after these guys had been transferred to Abu Ghraib. Said, we were also told they're nothing but dogs. Said, then all of a sudden, you start looking at these people as less than human, and you start doing things that you would never dream of. And that's when it got scary. Because the flesh, of course, is just sitting there and waiting for any opportunity to manifest itself. And as I've said over and over again, the three words that have really caused all the suffering in the world is they aren't us. And so if you conceptualize of them as dogs who you just need something from, then yes, things do get scary. And they get scary very quickly. You know, it's really interesting because when you look back on the history of America, I was reading an article this week about what traditionally has been the stance of America with regards to torture. And at the end of this movie, the father of the filmmaker, who was an interrogator in World War II, is reacting to what he has seen in this movie. And he's talking about the fact that he has lost faith in America. That they had never done anything like that to their prisoners in World War II. And yet, and then in the 80s, you had Ronald Reagan, who actually signed an act against torture, condemning torture. I think it was a UN sponsored resolution, and that anyone who engaged in torture would be brought up on charges and prosecuted. And just a decade and a half, two decades later, we have 9/11, and then out of that, because of fear, flesh takes hold and takes an opportunity. And, you know, maybe this stuff has always gone on and we have never known of it. But we very much, in the last decade, have acquiesced to and given our seal of approval to torture in this country. And that makes me very sad. So I had just watched this movie and been saddened by it, that this is what we had come to in our country. And Sunday night, I get a call from my son-in-law, and he says, hey, you should turn on the TV. I said, oh. He said, yeah. He said, they got Osama bin Laden. So I turn on the TV, and the first thing I see is a shot outside the White House of this spontaneous celebration that has broken out. People dancing up and down because Osama bin Laden has been killed. This makes me sad, too. Because I think, really, is this who we want to be as a nation? We are celebrating the fact that we went over and murdered somebody. Now, I know people are going to say, well, this is war, and we've got to go this, that, and the other. But it's really been fascinating to listen to the stories degrade. How first it was, they went in and there was this huge firefight, and they were using women for human shields, and how despicable they were, and how Osama bin Laden was armed, and so they shot him because they had to shoot him, because he was resisting. And then it sort of degraded from that to, well, they weren't really using women for human shields. And then, well, there really wasn't that much resistance in the compound. Pretty much there was a couple of guys who resisted on the first floor and they were killed. And, well, Osama bin Laden really wasn't armed, but there were weapons nearby. And it kind of goes on and on and on. And I was listening to a report on NPR tonight by a guy who had written a book that was called Al-Qaeda is Winning. And I had heard a lot of this before. And it really makes a lot of sense. He was saying that Osama bin Laden got his start in all this, fighting with the Mujahideen as they were fighting against Russia. And he saw how these little terrorist attacks and this, you know, hit-and-run type strategy really did work. And how that, let's see, we have a friend visiting with us, and it looks like I'm going to have to do something different to get my mail. So, one moment, I gotta turn around here. And out of all that, then when Osama bin Laden saw the Russian government collapse, the USSR collapse, that he actually believed that the war in Afghanistan, that they had not only defeated the Russians there, but because of the great economic cost, that that had been a contributor to the USSR dissolving. And so it has always been Osama bin Laden's plan, and thereby Al-Qaeda's plan, that they would bleed the United States to death. That what they would do, first of all, I'm getting my mail, is they would attack the United States and cause them to be able to be drawn into a war in Afghanistan, because they understood history. They understood that a foreign power had never succeeded in Afghanistan. And so what Osama bin Laden wanted was to drag the United States into a war in Afghanistan. And, of course, he accomplished that. And not only accomplished that, but accomplished dragging us into a war in Iraq as well. And then their next strategy was going to be to, I'm backing down my driveway here, so I'm going to have to turn around a little bit, was to have all these minor little attacks and do it in such a way that it wouldn't cost them very much money to mount these attacks, and yet it would cost a lot of money to protect against these attacks. So one of his lieutenants was actually saying that the package bombs that they were sending out several years ago that were intercepted, they said it only cost us $4,200 to put those package bombs together, but by the time you get all the new security, precautions in place, it's going to cost the industrialized nations billions of dollars, and they call that leverage. And it's a brilliant strategy. And frankly, it works because people are afraid. And when people get afraid, they start doing silly things, including they start torturing others, which of course does not help our case around the world at all. Which brings me back to my original feeling about all this. We can shake our fist at Al-Qaeda, and we can shake our fist at Osama bin Laden and dance around gleefully that he's dead. But none of that changes the fact that ultimately Osama bin Laden does not bear responsibility for what happened on 9/11. He does not bear it alone. Certainly he planned it and his people executed it, but it never should have happened in the first place if we had been on our game. I have a whole chapter in Still Whispers on this. We should have stopped that. And if we had been on our game and we had stopped that, we wouldn't be in Afghanistan, we wouldn't be in Iraq, we wouldn't have spent trillions and trillions of dollars and put our young men and our young women in harm's way like we have. Or even after it happened, if we had been adult enough to make the hard decision to look at ourselves and say, we failed. We do have enemies around the world. Let's try to figure out why there are enemies and how we can be wise about blunting their efforts and taking that tact as opposed to, well, we've got the greatest military in the world, so we're just going to go bomb them or we're just going to go invade them, because they're just going to be so grateful to see us. We wouldn't have spent trillions and trillions of dollars and the lives of thousands and thousands of our young men and women in the military. And things would have turned out a lot differently. Because when I look at all of our efforts, there are a lot of good people in the military, and they're just doing what they're ordered to do. So I got no beef with the military per se. But a lot of what I see happening, I just look at it and go, flesh, 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 flesh. And in the end, the flesh does not lead you to a path of victory or success. It leads you to defeat and failure. So I was kind of sad this week as I'm watching all of this stuff, and then this revives the whole discussion about, is torture justified? And I marvel at the fact that just a few decades ago, we would have never even had this discussion in this country. Because at the very highest leadership of our nation, there was a steadfast belief that torture was not acceptable. And one of the things that's really interesting in this documentary is they're talking to an FBI interrogator. And by the way, the FBI, when they started seeing this stuff that was going on, they pulled out. And they said, we're not going to be a part of this. But they talked to an FBI interrogator, and his assertion was, you never really get any good information out of torture, because either the person is going to tell you whatever you want them to tell you, or they're going to lead you down a garden path. This FBI, very skilled FBI interrogator, felt like the best way to get good, verifiable information out of people was with kindness. He said, I sit down with someone and say, look, you know, we know who you are. We know what you've done. The fact is, you are not getting out of here. It's over for you. But we understand you have a wife. You have children. What do you want? Do you want us to help your children go to a good school, get a good education? We can do that. But you're not getting out of here. And he said by just asking people what they want, they said, you know, basically your life is over, but your kid's life, your wife's life, something good can still come out of this. And we will do that. We'll take care of them. But you have to give us something in return. And he said, you know, by using those techniques, they were able to get a lot of good information instead of degrading to torture. They make reference, they don't call it this, but they make reference in the movie to Jack Bauerism. That we as a nation are sort of enamored with this idea of Jack Bauer, of the TV series 24. That here's a guy who's willing to make the tough decision and push the line and torture people because there's only seconds left and the bomb's going to go off and millions of people are going to die. We need more Jack Bauers. And one of the guys in the movie made the point. He said, you look back over the last 500 years and when has that ever really happened? When has it ever been that there's only seconds left before the bomb goes off? He said, that scenario doesn't happen. And yet we use that scenario all the time to justify the fact that we've got to get this information. And so we have to make the hard decision. We have to go to the dark side. That was always the kind of the line, you know, well, we had to make the tough decisions. And my response has been and will always be, that's not the tough decision. That's the easy decision. Your flesh may want you to think, oh, look, you're really struggling with this decision to do this when it's pushing you and pushing you and pushing you. But that's only because it pushes both sides at the same time. It's going to push you to do something that you know you shouldn't do, and then it's going to condemn you for doing it, and then it's going to push you harder to get you to do it. But in the end, it's not really that hard for any of us to adopt inhumane treatment of other humans. All we really have to do is just convince ourselves that they're not human, that they aren't us. And frankly, we as a human race have had a lot of experience with those three words. The tough decision is really to understand that in the midst of all that noise that the flesh is going to generate, of fear and terror and urgencies, the tough decision is to say there are certain principles that we are going to abide by. And it's really the basic principle of the Geneva Convention. And one of the things that, let me see if I can find it in my notes, one of the things that when I heard President Bush say it, I just went, oh, man. President Bush was actually quoting the Geneva Convention. And the quote he used from the Geneva Convention was, there will be no outrages upon human beings. And Bush's response was, that's very vague. What does that mean? And that made me very, very sad. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.